Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 132, a special episode in which we are presenting some recorded events from the 2025 Academy of Management Annual Meeting, held in Copenhagen, Denmark. For part one, we are presenting a panel symposium titled Multimodal Impact, Translating Academic Knowledge via Contextual, Collaborative, and Collectivist Modes, hosted by Malia Carvalho and our own Pedro Monteiro, both from the Copenhagen Business School. Along with Malia and Pedro, the panelists include Akshay Mangla from Oxford University, Stefan Manning from the University of Sussex, and Anne Muller from the Copenhagen Business School. To learn more about the event, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. The recording has been edited to remove extensive background noise and for brevity. Here is our co-organizer and host, Pedro Monteiro.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. So welcome to our symposium. It's wonderful to see you all. As you can see, the theme is about impact. And we are trying to think about that in terms of translating, disseminating academic knowledge. But you have the twist of thinking about multimodal means, which that happens, right? So it's great to see all the new faces. And, you know, I think that since we have a small group, we can have a more conversational, you know, events. So to start things off, I'll do a very short introduction. And then we're going to have a few presentations from the families. We have some questions for you to also probe your thinking. And then we're going to have the panel discussion, which I think we can do very conversationally in terms of, you know, Q&A and so on. One of our themes was about contextual and collective knowledge. So in a way, this setup seems to favor that. So just to make sure that we get some basic definitions of what we are talking about, right? We are thinking about translation. So, you know, we slap something here that helps us understand what we mean, which is basically about reinterpretation, adaptation, embedding of ideas into diverse organizational social aesthetic, right? Which is basically what happens when academic knowledge circulates beyond our realm into a variety of grounds. And, you know, in the literature, multimodal translation has been highlighted in terms of how verbal, visual, and material modes work together to support the transmission and transformation of ideas. And the idea is that we wanted to have a panel that speaks about different types of modes. So that's the panelists we have up here. And I forgot to say, of course, that I'm Pedro Loterio, and together with Malia, we are the organizers of the event, but besides being the organizers, we also, you know, be sharing some of our takes on this topic. So we're going to have first Akshay Mangla telling us about writing guidelines. So, of course, you know, the written, the verbal mode. Then we have Anmeta, and Akshay is, of course, coming from Baxter University. Anmeta is a local, like me and Manuel from CBS, and she'll be telling us about verbal deliberations. Then we have Stefan Mani, coming from the University of Sussex, that is going to tell us about idioms. Then Malia from CDS is going to tell us about embodiment. And I'm going to wrap things up talking about podcasts, right? So you can see the variety of visual, verbal, different types of verbal, printing, and so on. So, you know, we're going to start with Akshay telling us about, you know, what has to say about writing guidelines.
Hey, can you hear me? Yeah, sorry, I'll lean forward like you did a little bit. Maybe get a stance together like I'm about to run. Okay, well, hi everyone, and thank you, Pedro Malia, for organizing this and to the other panelists. So I'll just jump right in. You can hear me all right? Okay, I'll just jump right into this topic around translation and the use of written guidelines. I'll say a bit about the context in which I've been trying to do some of this work. Then I'll get into what the written guidelines are, and then the process of actually trying to utilize them as tools for translation, and then finally the challenges that emanate from that process. So just for context, a lot of the work I've been doing is on public sector reform in South Asia, predominantly looking at public agencies in India, frontline bureaucracies like police and education. And so the context I'll focus on here is the translation work for the research we've been doing with police around women's security in India. So there's, you could think of this as an effort to address, to research a complex challenge that has multiple dimensions. So there's a dimension of police itself being a difficult agency, and there's a colonial inheritance that many countries have around the police force and that hierarchy. There's the issue about women's safety. So there's a gender aspect in particularly norms of patriarchy in the setting in central India where I work. And then there's obviously the difficult issue about delivering a service under severe resource constraints impacting a lot of countries in the global south. So this is truly a wicked problem trying to address these issues. And I can go more into the particular issues of gender-based violence in India, but I'll just emphasize that these are all interconnected, these issues of patriarchy, colonial inheritance, and resources. Now, a police agency we've been working with the last, gosh, it's been about 7 years in central India, and actually we've co-designed interventions with them around women's safety. And so the impact work and the translation work actually began before the research, in the sense that we're trying to first understand what is the academic research telling us, translate that for the police in a series of meetings with senior officers, but then spend time in the field. So myself, my collaborators on in the ground, in the local police station, getting to know the frontline officers. And one thing we learned from that is actually there's translation work to be done between the senior officers and the frontline officer. There's a big gap of communication. In fact, initially, it was for us to understand the context, and officers were telling us from the field, this is what we're seeing given our constraints and so on. These are the ideas in academia around administrative reform, and these are the constraints and political constraints that the senior officers, the chief of police, have. So why written guidelines as a way to address these different, you could say, nodes in the chain? One, and I guess part of it is harnessing on some of the limitations or some of the challenges. Being a post-colonial state, there's an overemphasis in India on written documents for everything. A citizen goes to a government agency, you want even a slip saying you visited. It's a form of legibility, to use James Scott's terms. Now, these documents are ways in which officers are used to interacting. So when something needs to get done, senior officers write letters to the station. Even if they could call the station chief, they will always issue letters, and there's multiple letters. So it became clear that, when we talk to the officers, actually, they also like things in writing. And so in that process, we've designed with the police a set of standard operating procedures. These are SOPs for addressing women's cases, handling the case, the intake of the case, how to treat someone who comes to the station, all the way down to follow up and then ultimately go to the courts. And that's where the paper trail also becomes very important and why written guidelines matter. Now, I'll just say quickly, the guidelines are around gender sensitization, how to treat people, how to follow up, and who has what responsibility. So often the cases fall through the cracks because there's multiple responsibilities and then therefore no responsibility. So at each step in a case's life, who's responsible for what? What is the process? And this is not something we came up with. We reverse engineered. We did a pilot study first in just 5 police stations across a vast terrain that varied in terms of rural to urban, most higher resources, lower resources. And we tried to see if we could tweak these SOPs in a way that worked for the station, translating them, of course, into Hindi, but also into a particular form of Hindi that the officers use, right? But then also ensuring that this can then fit with the research design. So then we actually combined an experimental design where we had an RCT, where we actually disseminated these SOPs, but also training for the officers, and then a qualitative component where we, over time, spent time in the stations to see the uptake of the SOP. And in fact, it was this iterative process between designing the documentation, talking to the officers. So I think the next presentation is about deliberation, and I don't think documents and deliberation need to be antagonistic with each other, but they can be. And what we found was that in the process, it was very important to talk as well as it was to write. So officers could discuss, well, I have this issue when I dealt with the case. It doesn't fit the standard operating procedure. How do I deal with these exceptions? And it turned out that training sessions became opportunities to not just train officers, but to identify how did another adjacent station deal with the same challenge. So a lot of the translation work happened horizontally. It wasn't us as academics, it was officers themselves answering each other's questions and talking about how in similar contexts they arrived at workable solutions. Now, it was very important for this local contextual knowledge to make its way back up the chain. One thing I didn't mention is the colonial hierarchy in the police. One officer refers to it as a caste system, literally. Like the senior officers have a different eating area, they have a different lift. I made the mistake of taking the officer's lift once and got reprimanded. No, you have to go through the common lift. But that separation between the common rank and file and the senior officer is so stark that we have to make sure that what the officers on the ground are saying, it's really being heard. And so in that sense, I think some of what we're doing is translating within the organization. And that was really trying to help build trust as well. So I think through the guidelines, the senior officers saw that actually in police stations, this is not working. And so we worked with the senior officers to kind of reproduce. They had a monitoring dashboard, again, a document. These are the indicators we look at. These are the performance indicators for the stations. Can we adapt those based on what the stations themselves are saying is practical for them and can be more motivating? So in that sense, it was a two-way process. Okay, let me just conclude then, and I'm happy to take some questions when we all reconvene as a group. Just the challenges. So there was an uptake of this intervention, of the women's, you could say, reform intervention. A lot of the officers found themselves motivated, but there are three issues, I think, with the documents. One is, written guidelines can add to administrative burden if there's a lot of form filling that happens thereafter. And that happens to be the case where some officers felt, this is just a lot of documentation, I can't do this much of it. And that's a resource constraint, but also a time constraint. Then there can be a disconnection if the written guidelines say X and the live reality, the officer is Y, and they're very far. It becomes harder to believe what's written. So if the written guidelines say to the officers, do all of these things like almost like a superhero, but you have no resources. So there has to be, you have to close the gap between the guidelines and the local reality of the station. And that's another risk. Last thing I'll end with is the power dynamics. And this is still this is an ongoing issue that we face, is that there's officers who kind of have the confidence to do the work in of writing. They often tend to be higher up and they can kind of disseminate notes down. But then they often do not take into consideration all the exceptions that exist because there's vast heterogeneity across the terrain. And so the power dynamics of who gets to set the guidelines and who's a guideline recipient or taker, that still plays out. And so I'll just pause there, but hopefully there's some resonance with some of the other presentations. Thank you.
So I have been given the task of discussing the role of deliberation or talk as a mode for knowledge translation. Just a little bit of background. I come from the sociology, public management, public administration background, and my research focuses mostly on professional knowledge and practice in the context of public service delivery, or what we call human service organizations. So it's social work, daycare, healthcare, child protections, that type of work. Back when I started my PhD research about 10 years ago, there was a huge debate in most of these fields about evidence-based practice as the new ideal, and also a lot of pushback on that ideal. And in my PhD research, I was really interested in understanding what is the role of research in professional work on a daily basis and what can it be. So this is something that I've been thinking about and working with for many years. And eventually my research took kind of a different direction. And I ended up studying deliberation, among other things. But in terms of thinking about impact, I wanted to share this one quote, which has stayed with me from the beginning of my PhD research and still kind of informs how I approach my work today. So this is from Carol Weiss, who was a policy analyst and education researcher at Howard. And she says, "Social scientists tend to start out with the question, how can we increase the use of research in decision making? They assume that greater use leads to improvement in decisions. Decision makers might phrase it differently. How can we make wiser decisions, and to what extent, in what ways, and under what conditions can social research help? These are not the same question." And I think that's a really, really important point. And now you have it in writing. So if you can't hear anything else I say, at least I can leave you with this.
But I'm going to try to talk a little bit more about how this has informed my own approach.
Really, when I engage in any kind of dissemination or something that has to do with impact, whether it's my own work or the work of others, I really try to have this with me in the back of my mind and always approach the issue from the perspective of practitioners. In my case, that's mostly frontline professionals and also public managers. And it really means placing the problem or decisions or situations that they are dealing with as the starting point, as the center of what we're doing together. So rather than taking the research as a starting point and then kind of selling whatever product that someone has created or myself has created, it's about starting with what is the situation that you're facing, what are you trying to deal with, and how might research knowledge help you leap forward with that. And the way that I mostly do that is by engaging directly in conversations. Professionals and managers, they don't really care that much about research as such. Research in its own right is not necessarily that important. They care about dealing with the cases or the situation that they're facing. And these problems or cases or situations, they don't necessarily present themselves in a very sort of neat or orderly or actionable ways. And so the work with fires, sense-making, construction of problems, Donald Sherry referred to this as problem setting as well as problem solving. So you have to even understand what we're trying to deal with here and maybe the situation in a family or a healthcare issue or whatever it is. And so professional deliberation is sort of a routine practice of trying to understand what are we dealing with, what is the case, what's the situation, and how can we go about solving it. And this is really an act of what I would call collaborative knowledge construction or knowledge mobilization. So in these professional deliberations, frontline professionals really mobilize all forms and types of knowledge, and research can play into that, but only if it seemed useful and relevant in relation to the situation. So that means when you have these discussions about rigor versus relevance, which is kind of a classic, my perspective on that is that these things are not just there. They are always situational and they are always relational. They only make sense in relation to whatever it is that you are dealing with. And so that also means that in these processes, research becomes just a small piece in a very broad ecology of knowledge of all different types of facts based and embodied and all types of knowledge that might be useful to understand what we're dealing with. And so learning from this, and this is based on a lot of previous work from others as well as my own ethnographic work, and I've tried to understand these processes of professional decision making, the deliberation, and then I've tried to feed that into how I work with impact. And as I said before, I do that mainly by engaging in direct conversations. So this can be in teaching, this can be in seminars, in workshops with practitioners, and I try to kind of imitate that way of working. So always starting with the situation or the problem. So I will always, if I'm asked to do a seminar or workshop, it involves some sort of pre-meeting, maybe several pre-meetings, where I try to get to know the organization and what it is that they're dealing with, why they asked me to come. And I structure my presentation, if I have one, around that. And it's not then just about dealing with problems in some instrumental ways, but also with trying to understand what is the context that you're working with, what are the fundamental conditions of the work that you do, introducing maybe concepts like emotional labor, like indeterminacy, reflection, what does that mean to how you work if you're issues, and then creating some sort of common ground for further discussion. And then we can address, so what are the issues, what are the situations that we need to deal with here? And then really have a conversation about that. And so that means in that setting, I am not so much an expert as I am a knowledge broker. So it's really about not feeding information or knowledge, but trying to understand with all the stuff that I have in my head, what might be useful in this situation? What can I kind of bring forward that could make a difference here? And sometimes it's work that I've done myself. Sometimes it's work from others. Sometimes it's work that I love and agree with. And sometimes it's work that I am not necessarily a fan of. People that use methods that I don't think are that great or interesting, or people that use ideas that are kind of weird to me, but they might be useful in just that setting. And so being in this role is quite demanding because it really requires you to face your own biases and preferences. But it's also very rewarding because when you get that sense that something actually makes sense and you get that feeling of enlightenment on some maybe very small scale, it's just such a gratifying feeling. And so I think that direct engagement is really one of the most important ways that we can work with impact.
Okay, hello everyone. I guess my role was to talk a little bit about film and video, but I will kind of expand a little bit, also relating it to impact campaigns, which is a particular strategic form of translating different things into for different audiences. So let's see where this is going. I'll maybe just quickly do this. The main point of this slide is to say that I'm both an academic and 20% filmmaker, and I go to film festivals a lot and talk to filmmakers. And I'm interested in films as vehicles for social change. So that's one context here. And everybody knows, I think, this audience has so many different ways in which research is translated for different audiences. Today, there are knowledge brokers, impact managers, and all these different roles that have emerged. And one important aspect of all these roles is impact storytelling, which is a term that I see used a lot among filmmakers, but it's also something that's becoming more important in other fields. And the goal is to clearly communicate research to external stakeholders for different purposes, policymakers, communities, and so forth. And the means is the use of character-based stories, which is something I want to focus on here. And the attendant effect of this is to create an emotional connection with the audience around research that is otherwise very abstract and maybe very distant from the audience experience. Now, there's something to be learned about this kind of translation process from filmmakers, because filmmakers for a couple of years now, like 10 years or so, have been using impact campaigns as a very deliberate form of translating stories for different audiences. And they filmmakers hire impact producers who run those campaigns professionally in order to, for example, change policies and change behaviors. I'll just give you one example for this. It's a film that probably everybody knows, Dark Waters, with Mark Ruffalo. It's a film about DuPont, the chemical firm, and the way in which a lawyer takes on the tough task of going against this firm to defend a farmer whose cows died because of exposure to these chemicals. So it's a real story that was then used in this film. Now, why is it interesting? Because the film was used for an impact campaign called Fight Forever Chemicals. A website was created. There are different things that are being done. Like, for example, film screenings were organized for policymakers, decision makers, and business to get them to do something about these chemicals. And indeed, the campaign then managed to convince important stakeholders to remove these chemicals, to ban them, to propose bills. So really, some tangible stuff happened here. And I think that researchers can learn something from this, from these campaigns. I just want to do a little self-promotion here. I have a YouTube video, because I do video essays sometimes. This is a video essay about how films can make an effect in society. If you want to spend 8 minutes of your life in a good way, you can watch this film on my YouTube channel. Now, this is the main thing I want to talk about here, is how stories can be translated into impact campaigns. And one key to this is to think about the different layers of storytelling. One thing that I learned from filmmakers when I first started, a documentary film training in London some years ago, the instructor says something you need to be able to say about your film is three, you need to answer three questions. First question, what is the story about?
Second, what is the story really about? And was it really, really about? And I was, of course, like laughing a little bit. It's like, well, what is this? Is that a joke? You know, but it's not a joke. It's a way of saying there are different layers of abstraction of the same story, depending on how you see it. So there's, at the very basic level, a plot with characters who go through some struggles, solve the struggle, develop a solution for that. And that's the immediate plot that people understand directly. But then this plot is an example of a bigger story of situations people get into, struggles they have in certain contexts, certain cultural contexts, for example, and then ways of dealing with this. And at the very high, at the most abstract level, films talk about themes like justice, suffering, ambition, love, and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, at this very high level of abstraction, it becomes a little ambiguous. You know, what is the story really, really about? Well, that's a matter of interpretation. But because there's such an openness interpretation, this gives impact producers an opportunity to translate stories into impact goals for different stakeholders. For example, in the case of Starks Dark Waters, you have the immediate story of the farmer and the lawyer trying to fight DuPont. That's the immediate story. But that's a story of the danger of forever chemicals and a story about fighting powerful firms. That's the bigger story. And then this can be translated into actionable goals around social justice, pollution, and protection. And that's exactly what this campaign did. So why is this, how is this important for research? Well, I made this argument in a recent paper in Journal of Management Studies that actually you can think of research in terms of these three layers of storytelling. The first two layers are, for example, if you do case-based research, would be your immediate case that you talk about your company, your entrepreneur, whatever your case is. But then this case is an example of a larger mechanism or process or something you want to study. That's the theorizing that we are used to. That's the second layer. What is the story really about? What is it? Yeah. And this is all within the findings of your research. But then it becomes interesting. The third layer is what typical people think of like the broader implications, right? So what else is this about? You know, who do I talk to? Which audience? Like entrepreneurship scholars, innovation scholars, whatever. But that's not something most scholars pay too much attention to. Maybe they do. But actually, this is something you need to pay attention to if you want to think about impact. Yeah, this third layer, the broader implications. And so what I'm thinking here is that how researchers can learn from filmmakers is to think about, okay, if I want to talk to external stakeholders like policymakers, community leaders, and so forth, I need to translate my theorization into concrete stories, character-driven stories that create an emotional connection to my findings and that I can then communicate to the stakeholders. So that's what these arrows show. So basically, I translate first downwards and then upwards. Downwards to find concrete stories, emotionally impactful stories of characters, and then I use these stories to communicate a larger issue to the stakeholders. Now, the problem is that most of us, most academics, don't have the time or creativity or insight to think about these character-based stories. Very difficult to do. So maybe you want to do this. You want to collaborate with a filmmaker, for example, who has plenty of stories about characters going through stuff. And what filmmakers often lack is the second layer of storytelling. So in order for them to communicate to other audiences, they need to theorize based on their story. They need some evidence that what they're saying is relevant for other people as well. Well, hello, this is where researchers come in. They know a lot about this population level stuff, and they can collaborate on this level. You see these exchanges that I'm trying to mention here. So there's like a gap we can fill both ways. And that's a way for me to think about collaboration, if that's possible. Now, of course, we need to be careful with this. That's my final slide. That there are certain challenges when it comes to storytelling and research. You want to balance character-based storytelling with rigor. That's always a thing. You know, how rigorous is that? How generalizable is it? And all the kind of stuff. Impact campaigns also can be costly, constrained by funding issues. Academics may have limited interest in this kind of stuff. There's no incentive often at universities. And there's also impact fatigue. You know, we need to write these impact case studies and, oh my God, and then we want to be done with impact and not really think about the cool stuff that you can also do. So you need some, I would say, some creative, open-minded academic to engage in this or a different system, a different structure maybe to incentivize this form of storytelling. That's it. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Malia Carvalho. I'm from Copenhagen Business School, and my research looks at how academic concepts from organization and management theory are brought to life in practice through the body. So I primarily focus on the body and on embodiment as a mode of translation. So I don't just look at how concepts are talked about, but I look at how they're felt and how they're enacted and how they become inhabited through people's bodily presence in organization. A good example of this could be Amy Edmondson's concept of psychological safety. So the broader question that I've been working on in my PhD is how do ideas become internalized, enacted, and habitualized? So in other words, this means I look at how management concepts move from being abstract to becoming part of how people act and interact and are made sense of in their work. And so to study this, I draw on institutional translation theory and the embodiment literature from organization studies. And I do this to examine the importance of the body in making theories travel from academia and into practice. And I focus especially on managers and their roles as translators. And methodologically, I did long-term fieldwork in the Danish creative and digital industries, where I followed managers who were each trying to integrate these academic concepts into their organizations through their leadership. And I used interviews, observations, photographs, also a reflexive researcher diary. I also used my own bodily presence as a site of knowing so that I could capture how these concepts were understood, how they were mobilized, and how they were passed on through gestures and postures and relational interaction, both within the organization, but also in relation to me as a scholar. What I was trying to surface, what was already being lived and practiced, but was often very tacit. And it's this impact that these concepts had on the managers and how that impact was then transmitted on to the rest of the organization. So over time, what I observed was that the translation of academic concepts was deeply contextual, and it involved a lot more than just understanding information about theory, you know, understanding the logics. It required resonance, this really felt connection between a concept and the person that was meant to take it up. And resonance here is about uptake. So it's about how knowledge meets a person, where they are, but also more importantly, meeting them who they are. So it's not just about whether something makes sense. It's about how it lands, how it feels right in that given context in relation to their lived, embodied experience, which often also determines whether that knowledge is going to be taken up meaningfully rather than just being reproduced at some surface level. So in my analysis, resonance emerged as this really key mechanism where ideas move from mere awareness into this lived, embodied practice. And this is the translator's way of making a concept personally and situationally fit. So this is really this contextual element that we've talked about a little bit. And it's through this resonance that academic knowledge becomes actionable, durable, and ultimately really impactful in organizational life. And it also points to this more collaborative side of what I call embodied translation. I talk about this notion of personal alignment, which is how translators are actively tailoring the way that they physically enact academic knowledge to fit the moment and the context that they're inhabiting, but also staying attuned to their own way of being and the people that they're trying to reach with this knowledge. So this means paying attention to where others are emotionally, mentally, physically, but also to the institutional norms and expectations, and trying to find this sweet spot where an academic concept can be felt, taken up, and be given life. So ultimately, you know, concepts are not just something that sit in our heads. You know, they seep into our body and they're expressed through postures and tones and gestures, through the way that we show up and interact with others. And when this happens, it's not so much about a concept making sense. It's about making a difference because it shapes the way that we interact and relate and lead. So this is why I think the body and embodiment is important, because knowledge can then become passed on. We can make others feel it, make it, mirror it, and take it up. And in that way, academic ideas have impact within us because it changes how we inhabit our roles, but also through us, because we transmit them to others through our embodied interaction. So the body as a mode and embodied translation also, of course, has some consequences, if you will. I mean, there are some subtle hierarchies, of course, we need to pay attention to as, you know, whose bodies are seen as legitimate carriers of knowledge and ideas and whose are not. And when we personally try to align ideas, we can include others, but we can also exclude without being so aware of it, because it's often something we do without paying attention to it. And this includes, you know, people's style, history, and positionality that we need to be maybe more aware with. You know, bringing knowledge to life is not smooth or universal. It's extremely contextual, situated, selective, and that raises more political questions, which are at the heart of impact work. Who gets to do the translating? Whose way of knowing and moving become left at the margins? So embodiment offers a different lens on knowledge transfer and the kind of impact that our work has in practice. It shows that concepts live in people, but in ways that are hard to trace with the current metrics that business schools prefer. Theories don't just travel through verbal and visual modes, but they move through the body, through eye contact, proximity, movement, emotional attunement, through these small relational gestures of everyday work. But this is also where theories become meaningful, because this is where they're lived. This is where they shape how people move, don't move, hesitate, relate, which also shows us that impact isn't just about reach or citations. You know, citations don't capture when a student starts interacting differently after class, or a leader that reads an article and feels it resonate and changes how they engage with their staff. And this is often when we as scholars witness impact, right? We see it in changed behaviors with the people that we interact with and to whom we pass on our knowledge and our theories. So situated enactment is when we see theory matter to someone in a specific place with a specific history and a specific set of relationships. So for me, you know, translating academic theory into practice is really a match made in embodiment, because ideas only have impact when they can be felt and lived. Thank you.
Well, thank you everyone for sharing. I'm going to talk about podcasts. So the idea here is that there have been involved collective that has been producing and releasing episodes almost monthly about this podcast called Talking About Organizations, where we cover organizational theory, right? So I thought I would do two things. One, I'm going to give you a little bit of the behind the scenes of the origins and what the podcast does, and share some reflections based on both some comments we have received throughout those years and also some interviews I had started as part of a project in trying to present who is out there listening to us, right? Because we had been doing for such a long time, and I'm finally trying to understand a little bit more about how these ideas landing. So behind the scenes, so the podcast is available in all channels, right? Spotify and so on and so forth. It started in 2015, so you know we are at 10 years now. And the mission is basically to try to translate core ideas in organizational theory. And the important thing here is that we always focus on so-called classics, because we wanted to go beyond the latest paper or our own personal paper and think about the collective body of knowledge of the field. And I'm going to get back to this in a second. The other thing is that also that we want this knowledge to the public. So it's a Creative Commons, the ideas that everyone can not just listen, but use in any way. And throughout this time, we have done 127 episodes. And we have, these numbers are of course harder to fully know, but we know that there is much more people listening than there are against our theorists. So we know that there's some people listening beyond our own community. I think that that's the only reason that we try to have some metrics to just to know that there's something beyond academics. It has a format of a seminar. It's almost like a book club in which we come together and discuss the key ideas of a particular book or paper or set of papers. And, you know, the episode is wondering, it's a very long form podcast. It's meant to be almost capturing the same kind of seminar conversation that we have in our spaces. And it has an array of people, not just from IT, but also near the fields that bring their take on that. And we have covered what will recognize as classics in any syllabus, but also we had some special episodes with reportings from events. And also sometimes episodes in which you try to think about historical cases or movies and how we can think about that through organization theory. I thought I would have a slide with everyone that is involved. So one of the left are current hosts, the ones on the, the ones on the your left, the current hosts, the others on the right are previous hosts. So look, this is a pretty much a collective effort. In some episodes, we have guests, especially if it is within a topic that we have less familiarity, right? So you probably recognize some of these faces up here. That's what I had about the real logistics, but I wanted to take a minute to just, you know, lift up and share some reflections. The first reflection is because one of our call, we're trying to think about the role of context in knowledge, right? And I think we don't have a lot of content same of who is listening, right? That's the figure on the left. That is something I have been trying to understand more through interviews. How are these people using this? But we know that the contextual production or the reason is that we want to make available the type of conversation we have in spaces like his, right? The idea of the academic seminar, the way through which we as academics share knowledge with each other, right? Which is not just one directional, just one voice, but have a conversation in the day. So think of how PhD seminar about a reading. And it's interesting that one of the people that I had interviewed has said that this seems to be one of the strengths or value of the podcast, because the person says that approaching the podcast like an academic debate is interesting because this way you don't take for granted the ideas. And he says, you know, that the aha comes from when you hear people disagreeing, that the paper does not capture something. You know, these are the moments that the person says that they feel that they learn the most. When the debate arises, right, when there is different perspectives, when there is not the repetition of what is in the paper, but when the conversations try to cool out different assumptions, which again, I think that's what we try to do in our conversations. So it's interesting to see that this kind of conversation has an audience out there. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is collectivism. And it's interesting that Anna Mette, right, and Matt Malia have already touched on this, on thinking about not just our particular idea. You know, Stefan was also talking about that, thinking about the collaboration of, you know, people. Actually, I was talking about collaboration, collectivism, semiotic, and directive engagement and co-production. But what I want to think in terms of collectivism here is that try to move beyond disseminating one paper, the latest fashion and so on, which seems to be a lot of where the incentives are. Because I think that the unit of impact, if there is one, is collective, right? It's about having a shelf for a particular area of studies, having a syllabus of a particular topic, right? So trying to think that when people are going to use ideas and learn, it's not just about the particular concept or the particular thing, but has to have this body of knowledge that help the people understand that, right? So understand where it comes from. And it's interesting because this is a message that we have received from someone, and it's interesting that the person was reflecting on how, after having graduated, they still felt that was interesting to have some connection with the field somehow, with the different topics that existed. So the person says, last year I finished my MBA as a middle-aged student and found a missing piece in my life, learning with classes gone and no tests to work towards. I found your podcast and discovered both being able to more thoroughly flight in different real-life settings, and this has been amazing. I do not usually write podcasts, blah, 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 blah. That's not important. What is important is the idea that taking the experience of being in the classroom and continuing that, you know, as you move forward in your life. And the last point is about collaboration, but also in terms of chains of dissemination, which is something that we know already touched as well. I mean, we hear sometimes from colleagues that use the podcast for teaching. So we did like a map a few years ago. This is not updated and it's just based on people that have informed us. And there is many people that have not informed us that they're using. But it more or less correlates with what we see is the main hits on the website, right? So there's a lot of people in mostly West Europe, but also many in Brazil, India, Australia, and so on. And then I would just close with one message that we got from someone very far from our field about how the person seems to be doing this work of retranslating into a particular context, because the person says, I really enjoyed the episode. This one episode by Isabel Smith-Lee, the beautiful paper from the sort of a nursing hospital, and says that the person, you know, he's working as a psychiatrist in a teaching hospital in the US, and read the paper and used the podcast in a seminar that he has been running with some people in the hospital, right? So I think it was interesting case to show that You know, there is contextualization, use of teaching or whatever, or any kind of setting. I mean, fields that go beyond what we're used to. I mean, that are the refreshes that I had, and I look forward to our conversation now.
We wish to thank all the panelists for participating and allowing us to record the session. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.